The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the April 1st, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. You say you want a revolution? Do you know what you mean by that? By Gideon Lewis Krause. In June 2018, the political commentator Fareed Zakaria found himself in the Campo dei Fiori in the center of Rome with Steve Bannon, who was then President Trump's chief strategist. Bannon, whom Zakaria describes as a volatile personality and as a conduit for the international resurgence of nativist sentiment, had come to Italy to help convince two populist parties, one on the left and the other on the right, that their interests were aligned. He drew Zakaria's attention to a monument to Giordano Bruno, the 16th century poet and cosmologist who held Copernican views about the universe and was burned at the stake for heresy. Where Galileo sold out and recanted, Bannon explained, Bruno was a real hero. Zakaria was surprised by Bannon's admiration for Bruno, who was widely regarded as a progressive proto-Enlightenment figure. But Bannon was less interested in the substance of Bruno's opinions than in his uncompromising defiance. It was Bannon's conviction, Zakaria writes, that in times of turmoil, take no prisoners radicalism is the only option. In his new book, Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present, published by Norton, Zakaria concedes the turmoil, but resists the radicalism. Everywhere you look, he says, you can see dramatic change. The rules-based international order has been destabilized. Traditional left-right divides have been transfigured. The trade-friendly economic consensus of the post-communist era has yielded to protectionism and autarky. Given that we may be living through one of the most revolutionary ages in history, Zakaria thinks that lessons can be drawn from previous revolutionary ages, especially those that involved actual revolutions. The concept of revolution, Zakaria notes, is a slippery thing. How is it that Bannon, of all people, identifies himself as a revolutionary? Zakaria finds the problem embedded in the word itself. Revolution was originally employed to describe the orbital movement of a celestial body around a fixed axis. A full revolution is completed by returning to a starting point. But before long, the word acquired a secondary meaning, designating a rupture that renders everything utterly different. The word now refers at once to predictability and to transformation. Revolution is hardly the only word that contains its opposite. To sanction and to dust are similar in that way. But in this particular case, Zakaria sees something profound. Revolutions contain the seeds of their own undoing. Quote, radical advance is followed by backlash and a yearning for a past golden age imagined as simple, ordered, and pure, end quote. Taken to its logical conclusion, this idea would represent a cyclical idea of history, a fatalist notion that has recently found favor among conservatives. Zakaria believes that we can and do make progress, but he is wary of the assumption that history tends to move in the direction of ever greater human flourishing, a Whiggish view he associates with such frustrated optimists as Steven Pinker. Zakaria's book represents an attempt to distinguish between revolutions that have inspired the thermostatic reactions and revolutions that have endured. The most auspicious models, Zakaria suggests, might be found in the Netherlands and in England. In the 16th century, all of Europe was confronted with a series of economic, technological, and social shocks. The globalization spurred by the age of exploration, the innovations that emerge from war and from the necessity of economic expansion, and a, quote, radical identity revolution, end quote, driven by the Protestant Reformation. After most of the Netherlands threw off Habsburg rule in 1579, the Dutch formed a republic that capitalized on these changes. For reasons of geography, they were accustomed to diffuse authority. The need to reclaim land from the sea and the collective action required to do so, Zakaria explains, had ensured that feudal centralization never took hold. Quote, people had to work together to get anything done, end quote. Technological development in the form of windmills and dikes was a necessity for survival, and precocious urbanization provided an infrastructure for industry and trade. The cultural shift to Protestantism encouraged free thinking. Finance was democratized in the form of the world's first stock exchange, and the leaders of the republic were wise enough to ally themselves with the country's commercial interests. The Netherlands might have been early to liberalize, but that didn't mean it was exempt from what Zakaria describes as the familiar story of reaction. Quote, rapid advancement, dislocation, and then a wave of conjured memories of a lost golden age, end quote. The Dutch Republic was split between the economic dynamism of tolerant coastal technocrats and the atavistic impulses of more conservative rural populations that had been left behind by liberal merchants and bankers. The country's golden age came to an end in 1672 when the French invaded. A version of liberalism in the form of young William of Orange nevertheless survived and, 16 years later, was ported across the channel to lead a constitutional monarchy. England, like the Netherlands, was prepared to make a seamless transition to a liberal dispensation. The brilliance of England's glorious revolution, Zakaria thinks, lay in the collaboration of the country's Whig and Tory elites in a, quote, bipartisan escape from dangerous polarization, end quote, and in their agreement that, quote, English prosperity defined the national interest, not dynastic glory or religious zeal, end quote. A good revolution, as Zakaria tells it, is not initiated by political actors. It occurs when exogenous shocks in the form of economic or technological trends are tamed by competent management. Liberalism flourished in the Netherlands and in England because revolution was a bottom-up process in those countries. When Dutch and English leaders saw fit to intervene in the course of human affairs, they were content merely to implement, confirm, and codify the transformations that had already taken place in society beneath the surface of politics. These revolutions succeeded insofar as they were scarcely needed. A good revolution respects the limits of natural forces. A bad revolution crosses a line and provokes the backlash necessary to maintain equilibrium. Zakaria's counterexample to the Netherlands and England is France, whose revolution was a grisly failure insofar as revolutionary elites tried to impose modernity and enlightenment by top-down decree on a country that was largely unready for it. The reign of terror and the consolidation of power under Napoleon, Zakaria says, proved that social change must take place organically. Zakaria's descriptions of revolutionary activity make a great din. When things aren't plunging or soaring, they have skyrocketed or ricocheted. But his evocations of historical inflection points feel dutiful and formulaic. They are also confusing. After a while, one can't help but wonder what Zakaria means by revolution. What he calls the Dutch Revolution seems to refer to the entirety of the country's golden age, which lasted about 90 years and ended with the Republic's abrupt decline. were invited, with fine ill logic, to compare the success of the Industrial Revolution with the failure of the French Revolution, even though a failed Industrial Revolution would be no Industrial Revolution at all. He identifies the English Revolution with the Glorious Revolution, treating decades of bloodletting and repression as mere prelude to a crowning moment of liberal reconciliation. By this reasoning, one might claim that the Russian Revolution culminated in Glasnost. Nor is it clear what Zakaria means by top-down or bottom-up. The French Revolution failed because the elites tried to force top-down change, but the Glorious Revolution, which might better be described as a coup by Dutch commercial interests, somehow reflected a wise acquiescence to bottom-up processes. The specifics of revolutionary activity seem of secondary interest. Zakaria takes solace in the fact that civilization seems able to heal itself. The revolutions of 1848, for example, may have been crushed by societies mired in primordial autocracy, but everything that they hoped to enact, the proliferation of human freedoms, was almost invariably adopted through gradual reform. The implication is that what the vanguard struggled to achieve by fiat was going to happen anyway. All they had to do was sit tight. Most revolutions have, at one point or another, had their revolutionary credentials challenged. Events that purportedly failed to rise to the radical occasion include the English Revolution, merely a bid for bourgeois power, skeptics say, the Mexican Revolution, a rivalry between warlords, and even the French Revolution. The American Revolution is a recurring example. At the time, it seemed as though an awful lot changed after 1776. In retrospect, many things, in fact, remain the same. Some historians have introduced further distinctions without introducing further clarity. The colonists' struggle against the British, it has been suggested, qualified as a political revolution, but did not meet the criteria for a social revolution. This, however, is just a restatement of the observation that the same set of historical episodes might, with equal plausibility, be described from one point of view as continuous and from another as a break. The word revolution may be perfectly useful as a complement we pay to inflection points for developments that are, by consensus, important. But the attempt to provide a load-bearing definition might be more trouble than it's worth. In The Age of Revolutions and the Generations Who Made It, published by BASIC, Nathan Pearl Rosenthal, a professor of history at the University of Southern California, offers what he calls an anti-exceptionalist history of the Age of Revolution. In his view, there is an alternative way to understand why the great transatlantic revolutions that straddled the turn of the 19th century in the United States, France, Haiti, and Latin America are often said to have failed. Unlike Zakaria, Pearl Rosenthal doesn't really believe that counter-revolutionary or illiberal reversals prove that the early revolutionaries were overweening. He argues, instead, that the degree to which these revolutions met or did not meet their egalitarian aims should be understood in the light of processes that took a full generation to unfold. In 1972, Henry Kissinger asked the Chinese premier, Zhou Enlai, what he thought of the French Revolution. Zhou is said to have responded that it was too early to tell. The story apparently turns on a miscommunication. Zhou was probably referring to the events of 1968 rather than those of 1789. But it persists for a reason. Pearl Rosenthal doesn't go that far. But like a professor who generously grants extensions before grading, he thinks that revolutionary fervor can be assessed only as the spark of a longer undertaking. Pearl Rosenthal's book follows several members of what he calls the first generation of gentlemen revolutionaries. His cast includes famous political actors such as John Adams, less well-known but influential women such as Maria Rivadeneira, a prioress in Peru, and Marie Bunnell, a merchant in Haiti, and more run-of-the-mill figures like Francis Louis Augustin Bosch, now best known for the pears that bear his name. Pearl Rosenthal believes that these figures had considerable difficulties overcoming the hierarchical reflexes of the mid-18th century Atlantic old regime in which they had grown up. Theirs was a largely closed world of intimate relationships and norms opaque to outsiders. Their social attitudes made it difficult for them to forge alliances beyond their station. Take Rivadeneira, who presided over a convent in Cusco, Peru, in the last century of the 18th century. Her ancestors had come to South America with Francisco Pizarro, and she was raised in luxury as part of the imperial colony's criollo elite. She liked ballads sung from balconies and farces performed in the evenings. Her skirts were inlaid with mother-of-pearl medallions, and she took chocolate for breakfast. In 1780, a member of the native nobility, Tupac Amaru, launched a revolt against the Spanish. At the time, Pearl Rosenthal notes, it was easy to imagine that the interests of the native and those of the criollos might be united against an extractive empire. Rivadeneira herself seems to have considered the possibility of such an alliance. In the end, however, she and her family led a defense of Cusco that turned the war against Amaru, who was executed. Rivadeneira, like the other figures of Pearl Rosenthal's first revolutionary generation, never lost sight of the interests of her caste. But even if she had given freer rein to her sympathy with the rebellious natives, Pearl Rosenthal argues, the two worlds were simply too far apart for such a political confederation to be realized. He is a careful reader of personal letters, attentive to the codes of polite salutation that marked the worthiness of a correspondent. His principals had sparse experience with the cultivation of cross-class coalitions, and there was no social infrastructure that might have afforded them opportunities to learn. Hereditary inequality was too great. The coalitions that did emerge were held together weakly by the mere agreement among individuals that what they wanted was not this, or they arose by default. The wealthiest people were risk-averse because they had a lot to lose. The poorest people were risk-averse because they couldn't afford to lose the little they had. Insurrectionary outbreaks were thus almost random. Pearl Rosenthal takes as one example the storming of the Bastille. The working classes in Paris, conditioned by decades of increasingly separate living, had a remarkable capacity for self-organization, he writes. Yet the same social realities that had made them effective self-organizers also defined the horizon of their political vision. The dark, crenellated fortress of the Bastille seemed like a reasonable target. It just looked like a place that deserved storming. And it was, if only symbolically, which is why we remember it. As a strategic objective, however, the Bastille, which housed nothing of royal or military importance, left something to be desired. The crowd's unfamiliarity with which sanctum actually mattered, Pearl Rosenthal says, spurred action against places and people who did not, in fact, have much power to meet their demands. This miscalculation wasn't the protesters' fault. They had no way to obtain the right information or to develop the proper alliances. In Pearl Rosenthal's telling, the revolutions on the other side of the Atlantic followed a similar script. The social stratification of the pre-revolutionary era, in each case, provided little room for egalitarianism. The United States Constitution was the product of a successful revolution from above, he writes. The Constitutional Convention itself was a virtual coup by the elite against the existing government. Something comparable happened in Haiti. Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the Haitian Revolution, was born into slavery. But even as a freedman, he remained a product of a hierarchical world. Although this revolution had begun as a revolt from below, Louverture tried to transform it into a revolution from above, falling into what one recent biographer has described as an authoritarian spiral. In his attempts to protect the nascent country's independence, he was perfectly willing to send the masses back to their plantations in a condition of near bondage. Elites acted this way because they were certain that only they could know what was best for everyone. But this was a generational limitation, and it eroded with time. If such men as John Adams and Toussaint Louverture could only imagine rearranging the game pieces, Pearl Rosenthal says, they nevertheless enabled their successors to upend the board. They had managed to irretrievably fracture the old regime. Out of the disarray, new people and new kinds of politics were beginning to emerge. As classes started to mix, movements became broader and more heterogeneous. When the United States Capitol moved to Washington, D.C., elected officials and other elites had no choice but to room and drink with men of the lower orders. In the provinces, the 1790s saw the coalescence of the Republican Party, which took shape as a mass organization that united elite and working-class voters. Drinking together led to durable institutions that advanced more equitable forms of mobilization, expanding the franchise to vote and political participation more generally beyond property owners. In Latin America, solidarity movements succeeded in an extended campaign for independence from the Spanish crown, though, as Pearl Rosenthal notes, the revolutionary results frequently assumed an illiberal cast. In Haiti, the militarized coercion of the Louverture era and its immediate successors coalesced into a pattern of one-man rule, even as the country's development was hamstrung by punitive foreign debts. As a piece of scholarship, Pearl Rosenthal's book is a persuasive and inspired contribution to perennial historical debates. Was the American Revolution a project of radical egalitarianism? Or was it simply a transfer of elite power? Was the French Revolution stymied by external forces of reaction? Or was it fundamentally illiberal to begin with? His response is that we should not limit our gaze to supposedly sharp turning points and dramatic transformations, but instead narrate the past as a series of successive and intertwined campaigns to improve our estate. Pearl Rosenthal's book is written for a general readership, and he makes the further case that the stakes of this enterprise extend beyond those of scholarship. He writes, "Buying into this fantasy of instantaneous revolution has significant consequences, most damagingly, a potential loss of faith in the possibilities of change if the transformation fails to arrive as quickly as expected." It's little wonder that our current political climate, in which the stagnation and senescence at the top can feel disconnected from agitation and ferment below, has called forth treatises on revolutionary ages. Electrifying visions of the future seem in short supply. As the writer and historian Steve Fraser put it in a recent essay for the magazine Jacobin, the right and the left have settled on competing calls not for revolution, but for restoration. Both Zakaria and Pearl Rosenthal want to shore up our faith in transformative incrementalism, the idea that we might extricate ourselves from this mess by putting one foot in front of the other. Zakaria's book concludes that revolutions fail when they're visited on societies that are unprepared to adapt to new conditions. He has little to say about what kinds of outcomes might be desirable, but much to say about what we should not do. He's very concerned about the rise of identity politics. Although he opens his book with the Bannon anecdote, he implies that men like Bannon aren't worth worrying about and are best seen as a reaction engendered by an overreaching left. In a 2022 opinion piece for the Washington Post, Zakaria suggested that the problem with the Democratic Party was that it was too concerned with pronouns. A fixation on contemporary identity politics helps explain his assessment of revolutionary precedents. The Glorious Revolution was good because the conservative and liberal elites of the time agreed to stop harping on religious differences and focus instead on economic commonalities. Their French counterparts, a century later, failed to heed this lesson. The Reign of Terror, Zakaria says, shows how appeals to exclusive categories of identity can easily get out of control. When everyone is either a patriot or a traitor, heads will roll. Technological lurches, such as the rise of artificial intelligence, are scary, but the social order can be preserved, and the pendular threat of backlash staved off, as long as politicians do not use identity to pander to anxious constituencies. Where politics was once overwhelmingly shaped by economics, politics today is being transformed by identity. This may be an untenable distinction. Economic interests are not simply waiting to be revealed. They're mediated through social identity. And that's true even of political groups defined overtly through economic relations. As the historian E.P. Thompson put it, the working class made itself as much as it was made. If economics directly shaped politics, people like Maria Rivadeneira would have allied themselves with the natives against the Spanish. Those common interests had to be constructed, made socially legible through a process of trial and error. In this respect, Pearl Rosenthal's book can be taken as a story of how novel forms of solidarity became available to a post-revolutionary generation. The new cohort was no longer enthralled to the old regime's social structures. What the first generation broke, in his account, the second generation was able to piece back together more deliberately. An abatement of inequality created the occasion to gather and make trade-offs. These trade-offs required sustained personal interactions among heterogeneous groups that scarcely existed in an earlier era, further reducing inequality. This was not a matter of giving up on identity politics, but a matter of reshuffling and expanding the kinds of identities that mattered. Pearl Rosenthal suggests that in the early decades of the United States, the Republican Party afforded a mechanism for a more capacious national self-image, one that could encompass both elites and commoners. With the tumult of the American Revolution behind them, the longing for freedom in theory gave way to the administration of particular freedoms in practice. Those freedoms were, needless to say, unevenly distributed, which is one of the reasons that some critics have written off the American Revolution. At the end of Pearl Rosenthal's introduction, he suggests that his anti-exceptionalist story of revolutions might put to rest the notion that the American Revolution was distinctively tainted by the patriot movement's imbrication with slavery and racism. His primary reference here seems to be the Time Magazine 1619 Project, with its charge that the putative egalitarianism of the framers was little more than a lie. What this interpretation leaves out, according to Pearl Rosenthal, is that all the transatlantic revolutions began to unfold at an accelerating pace as the initial revolutionary vanguard was swept aside. By our lights, it is monstrous that this branching egalitarianism remained racist and exclusionary, and that freedom for some entailed the perpetuation of violent bondage for others. But there was nothing singular about this compromise. After all, Haiti freed the enslaved, but maintained a system of plantation agriculture that was virtually indistinguishable from slavery. Contemporary activists on the left like to quote Emma Lazarus and Maya Angelou to the effect that none of us are free until all of us are free. This is lovely as an aspirational ideal and powerful as an exhortation, but it should not be mistaken for an empirical claim. Pearl Rosenthal's book shows in detail how some people achieved a measure of freedom while others remained in chains. The we of We the People represented an expansion of the circle of moral concern. It took, and will take, a lot more work to expand that circle further. If we act in good faith to reckon in this way with the pervasive illiberalism of the revolutionary era, Pearl Rosenthal offers, this discussion might point to an exit from today's heated debates about the rot at the core of our nation's founding. It could replace the low hum of mutual suspicion and the fantasy that a true revolution can come only at the hands of the morally pure, with a renewed commitment to the unglamorous work of political organization. His emphasis on the logistics of solidarity reminds us that moral advances are neither a salutary byproduct of economics or technology, as Zakaria seems to think, nor a matter of progressive inevitability. Still, the analytic edge of Pearl Rosenthal's account, like Zakaria's, is blunted by its central historical category. The concept of revolution, especially in contrast to mere reform, conveys an exhilaration that's hard to relinquish. Yet it's worrying when an argument places weight, as Zakaria's does, on an honorific that encompasses both the removal of Louis XVI and the widespread adoption of steam power. Pearl Rosenthal does his best to preserve something productive in the idea of a grand event that requires a generational shift to fructify. But this scheme, he seems to concede, makes more sense in the case of the United States than it ever did in Peru or in Haiti. The halting progress he describes so well could just as easily be portrayed as a result of distinct campaigns rather than as belated aspects of a dramatic and all-encompassing movement. Perhaps the most revolutionary step we could take would be to relax our grip on revolution itself. Next, from the April 1st, 2024 edition of The New Yorker, has capitalism been replaced by techno-feudalism? By Sheila Kolhatkar. I never planned to be a politician. Never. Not in my wildest nightmares, the economist and former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis said the other day. He was fighting his way toward the exit at Columbia University's Alfred Lerner Hall, where he'd just spoken at a conference on sustainable development. A man blocked his path. 5 minutes, professor? He introduced himself as a UN employee. I'm Italian, he said. Nobody's perfect, Varoufakis said, laughing. I'm Greek. Varoufakis, who is tall and bald, with a rakish demeanor, wore boots and a black trench coat like a character from The Matrix. In 2015, amid one of the worst financial crises in Greece's history, he was appointed by the country's new left-wing government to try to save the financial system and to fend off punishing austerity measures that the country's creditors had proposed in exchange for a bailout. During the negotiations, the Financial Times called him the most irritating man in the room. The press referred to Varoufakis as the rock star finance minister and noted his leather jackets and glamorous artist wife, Danai Stratu. So what that I have a motorcycle, he said. I live in Athens, and there's no way you can get around in a car. Varoufakis is still bitter about the way his tenure ended, 6 months in. He was criticized for appearing in a flashy Paris match spread at a time when the Greeks were suffering economically and shortly before the country's prime minister abruptly agreed to the type of bailout that Varoufakis had been resisting. He resigned. "I shall wear the creditor's loathing with pride," he wrote on his blog. "I wanted to do one thing," he said, hailing a cab to take him to the Guggenheim Museum, a regular New York stop. "Restructure Greece's debt. If you're bankrupt and your bankruptcy gets bigger by getting more credit cards, this is a cycle. I wanted to break this doom loop, and I failed." He added, "I don't regret it for a second, but politics stinks." Varoufakis just published his 17th book called Techno-Feudalism. Capitalism, he argues, has been replaced by a new economic system that's more dangerous than anything Marx could have conjured. The big tech companies, Meta, Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, control our attention and mediate our transactions, he says, turning humans into digital serfs, incessantly posting, scrolling, and buying on their platforms. Rather than chasing profits that derive from labor, the tech overlords, whom he called cloudalists, extract rents. In the book, Varoufakis refers to Homer, Hesiod, Mad Men, FDR, Batman, and Thomas Edison to illustrate what has happened since people started staring at smartphones for most of their waking hours. Under feudalism, a landowner would grant fiefs to vassals who would farm the land and give a portion of the yield to the landowner. Varoufakis writes that Jeff Bezos' relationship with the vendors on Amazon.com is not too dissimilar. But the new setup is a bigger threat to representative government than even the old capitalism was. The cab pulled up to the Guggenheim. As Varoufakis paid the fare, he explained that although he's a critic of technology, he still uses it, especially X. "I'm all day on Twitter," he said. "I hate it." Was it Stephen Fry, the English writer and actor, who said that it's like taking all the graffiti from male toilets and posting it online? Varoufakis hadn't checked the museum's exhibition schedule, but said that he liked surprises. A show called Going Dark, the contemporary figure at the edge of visibility, featured images of people wearing hoodies and shrouds and eerie sculptures of staggering giants bathed in green light. As he peered at the shadowy figures, he said that the only thing that could counter the new tech feudalism was a revolution in which citizens took control of the algorithms and put them under democratic oversight. A tall order, he admits in the book. He stared at a large Chris Ofili painting that was almost entirely blue. "When I get seriously depressed, it's art, music, and Star Trek," he said. "I'm a Trekkie, by the way. Absolutely fanatical. I've seen every single one." He especially loves The Next Generation, in which Patrick Stewart plays Captain Jean-Luc Picard. "The major reason why I like it is because it's a post-capitalist socialist world," he said. "There's no money, there's no profit, and there is a primary directive. We do not interfere with other races," which is exactly the opposite of the imperialist directive. He recalled a favorite episode in which the Enterprise crew thaws several people who were cryogenically frozen. There is a fantastic dialogue between Captain Picard and a businessman from the 1990s who demands to see his lawyer because he had a lot of investments on Wall Street. And Picard says, "My friend, these were all illusions which are no longer current. We have overcome the need for material possessions." The ideal system, Varoufakis went on, might be called anti-techno-feudalism, with technology working for all of us in a perfectly democratic way and the removal of systematic exploitation on the basis of who owns what. "That's Star Trek," he said. "Whereas I hate Star Wars, Star Wars is the Middle Ages with laser guns." Next, also from the April 1st, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, Percival Everett's philosophical reply to Huckleberry Finn. In his new novel, James, Everett explores how an emblem from American slavery can write himself into being. by Lauren Michelle Jackson. Percival Everett's novels seem to ward off the lazier hermeneutics of literary criticism. Yet, they also have a way of dangling the analytical ropes with which we critics hang ourselves. His latest novel follows the misadventures of a runaway named Jim and his young companion Huckleberry in the antebellum American South. As in another novel featuring those protagonists, Jim has fled enslavement in the state of Missouri, and Huckleberry, Huck for short, has faked his own death to escape his no-good abusive pap. As in that other novel, the two are both bonded and divided by the circumstances of their respective fugitivity as they float together on a raft down the Mississippi River. As in that other novel, the narrator of Everett's book is setting down his story as best he knows how, but rather differently. The narrator here is not the boy, but the man who has been deprived of the legal leave to be one. "With my pencil, I wrote myself into being," Jim writes. The novel is titled simply James, the name Jim chooses for himself. In conferring interiority and literacy upon perhaps the most famous fictional emblem of American slavery after Uncle Tom, Everett seems to participate in the marketable trope of writing back from the margins, exorcising old racial baggage to confront the perennial question of, to use another worn idiom, what Huck Finn means now. And yet, with small exceptions, James meanders away from the prefab idioms that await it. What novel has borne the racial freight of American letters like Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, a book credited with gifting us a national literature, not to mention a sense of humor? Norman Mailer, rereading the book on the occasion of its centennial, wrote of realizing all over again that the near burned out, throttled, hate-filled dying affair between whites and blacks is still our great national love affair. A decade later, as Americans fretted over the educational value of a book busting with more than 200 instances of the word N-I-G-G-E-R, Toni Morrison defended Huckleberry Finn's status as a classic. The novel's brilliance, she observed, lies in how it formally reproduces the very racial dynamic it depicts. Jim enables Huck's moral maturation. Without him, Twain's Roman has no Bildung. Jim's freedom is withheld, Morrison writes, lest there be no more story to tell. James posits a converse narrative problem. From the perspective of Jim, a man undertaking a deadly quest for freedom, managing the needs of a pubescent boy amounts to nothing so much as an inconvenience. Jim's worries for his own family, a wife and child he's left behind in bondage, must be slotted into the spaces between the boy's gabbing, his questions, his anxieties. Jim's sentiment toward Huck is unruly in its ambivalence. He is simultaneously protective and resentful, both relieved and uneasy when the two are separated, which in Everett's novel they often are. With the boy in tow, Jim is mobile but stuck. Riding himself into being means leaving Huck and much of Huck behind. Since releasing his debut novel in 1983, Everett has published roughly a novel every other year, in addition to dozens of short stories, essays, and articles, plus a children's book and a half dozen poetry collections. His fictional protagonists have ranged from ornery cowpokes to professors of esoterica. Much of his work is narrated in the first person, yet his I is often a fragmentary and destabilizing affair. In my favorite of his books, Percival Everett by Virgil Russell from 2013, the identity behind the pronoun in question is twofold and indeterminate. Such mechanics have earned Everett a reputation as an experimental author, though that descriptor alone does little to disambiguate his eclectically proliferating oeuvre. As Everett put it in one interview, "I don't know what avant-garde or experimental means. Every novel is experimental." He has cited Twain as an influence, and it's worth noting that Twain, contrary to his canonization as the singular author of a singular American novel, also tried lots of stuff out, confounding readers of his time. As the longtime Twain scholar Shelley Fisher Fishkin has written, each time critics thought they had him pegged, Twain set out in a new direction. Insofar as there is a consistent motif in Everett's work, it might be what he himself has described as an interest in language and how language works. In his 2001 novel, Erasure, which was adapted last year into Cord Jefferson's film, American Fiction, an author who has been told that his style isn't black enough spews out a novel of the ghetto to wide and lucrative acclaim. Call it expediently located irony or convenient rationalization, but I was keeping the money, he says. In no small irony, Erasure remains Everett's most popular work. James, in a sense, reprises the same linguistic drag in reverse. Early in the novel, we learn that Jim's famous I dialect from Huckleberry Finn is, in Everett's telling, a strategic form of code switching. The enslaved have dumbed down their speech for the sake of soothing white nerves, when among themselves they speak in crystalline learned English. Will that be an example of proleptic irony or dramatic irony? One character asked, sharing a laugh with Jim behind the back of a white man too self-important to recognize himself as the butt of the joke. In a droll early scene, before Jim flees, he schools his daughter Lizzie on how to address the mistress, Miss Watson, about her cooking. But what are you going to say when she asks you about it? I asked. Lizzie cleared her throat.
Miss Watson, that's some cornbread like I never before ate.
Try dat be, I said. That would be the incorrect grammar.
Dat be some a cornbread like never I ate, she said.
Very good, I said. There is a didactic quality to this conceit that can grow a bit tedious. Safe movement through the world depended on mastery of language fluency, Jim offers, as though the idea demanded a plain-spoken explanation. But a fruitful tension arises from the possibility that Jim will unwittingly endanger himself by committing a language slip. On the run with Huck, Jim debates Voltaire and Locke while dreaming, including during a period of delirium brought on by a venomous snake bite.
"Yo sure talk funny in your sleep,"
Huck remarks, a comical reminder that Jim was not the only character Twain endowed with dialect. Fishkin, in fact, proposed that Twain may have borrowed from African-American voices in developing Huck's way of speaking. But, as in other Everett novels, speech only gets a person so far. To get any proper thinking done, Jim must work out his ideas on the page. In a scene reminiscent of one in Twain, Jim suggests that Huck slip away for a while, in a feminine disguise, to scope the happenings on shore. In Everett's version, the reprieve enables Jim to write, with a stick and some stolen ink, his first words. My interest is in how these marks that I am scratching on this page can mean anything at all. If they can have meaning, then life can have meaning. Then I can have meaning. The story that follows dexterously summons the grand, stumping immensity of that if. In past novels, Everett has evoked and chided the wisdom of French language theorists regarding the instability and plurality of meaning. In James, he shows how 19th century America, no less than present-day America, plays fast and loose with its most valued idioms, that is, race and money, and the material consequences, alternately grave and fortuitous, of doing so. What is the validity of a bill of sale, the novel poses, when any white con man can claim the nearest black person as his own? Is there a meaningful difference between one lynching and another, when seeing 10 was to see 100 with that signature posture of death, the angle of the head, the crossing of the feet? The cost of stealing a pencil exceeds monetary value. It may cost you your life, as Jim learns, though to be enslaved is to know precisely what one's hide is worth. When at some point Jim notes the similarity between a live slave and a dead runaway, another character calls BS. Is it better to die free, or is that BS too? Everett mines the humor in such logical convolutions, though the book's tone is more muted than that of his jocular novel, The Trees, from 2021, which features his own spate of lynchings. In one scene, a good master lashes Jim until he passes out, and Jim comes to asking if he is alive. "I'm sorry to tell you, yes," his companion responds. Among the departures from Twain's text is a subplot involving Jim performing in a minstrel troupe and donning blackface alongside the white actors. He discovers that Norman, another performer in the group, is passing as white. Jim describes the motley crew. There we were, 10 white men in blackface, one black man passing for a white and a painted black, and me, a light brown black man painted black in such a way as to appear like a white man trying to pass for black. The farce works because, as Everett's work has often shown, race itself is something of a farce. As James observes, never had a situation felt so absurd, surreal, and ridiculous, and I had spent my life as a slave. Erasure draws its slippery epigraph from Twain. I never could tell a lie that anybody would doubt, nor a truth that anybody would believe. In James, the path toward freedom depends on realizing the distance between how things are and how things are perceived to be. Approaching a technique he learns from Twain's famous hucksters, the Duke and the King, Jim teams up with Norman to enact a scheme of their own. Norman will, again, pose as a white man and sell Jim. Then Jim can escape and Norman can sell him again, thus accruing them enough money to free family members who remain enslaved. They carry out exactly one transaction before things fall terribly apart. The story's bloody, propulsive denouement includes a slave insurrection and a surreal trip into the bowels of a riverboat, where Jim and Norman learn the vital distinction between the ringing of four bells and seven. Jim, by this point, has lost the will to bite his own tongue. He tells Huck when they're reunited, "Belief has nothing to do with truth. Believe what you like. Either way, no difference." Everett never gives the sense that James needs Huck, not like Huck, as he tells Tom Sawyer toward the end of Huckleberry Finn, needs his N-I-G-G-E-R, Jim. And yet, like its predecessor, James finds surprising poignancy in the bonds between the pair, however burdensome for Jim the relationship may be. Jim cannot easily shake Huck off, for reasons that Huck and the reader discover by the story's end. The boy may be a nuisance, but he is a huge, persuasive, affecting one. Everett, like Twain, has often been called a satirist, but satire is ultimately a limp and inadequate label for what Everett is up to with his searching account of a man's manifold liberation. "How much do I want to be free?" Jim asks himself early in the novel. Huck won't be of much assistance in answering that question, and neither will Twain, for that matter. Next, a poem from the April 1st, 2024 issue of The New Yorker. "To You" by Maxine Skates. I know grief, and you may know it too. But I have reached the age where it is perpetual. I didn't know it would be like this, so I'm telling you, who still have a whole lifetime to forget your grief the way I forgot Angie, who wore too much eye makeup, whose skirts were too short for a seventh grader, or so the girl's VP said, who did not come to school one Monday, having died over the weekend of spinal meningitis, and disappeared from the life she would have lived while I forgot her, as I lived those years she never had. Though now she comes back often, looking ahead of her time in her black skirts and torn fishnets. And now, when I do not have my whole lifetime ahead of me, the phone rings, and another has suddenly passed, and she is as young as when I first knew her, before her daughter was murdered. And she took her grief and fought for gun control, and became a counselor, and wrote a play in which time collapsed, and her daughter starred alongside her. And if you think her having done all of that and more makes her death any less sudden, it does not, which is what makes grief perpetual amid our ongoing die-off. Yet I am still here, and this morning I do have more to tell you. Just hours ago, the sun filtered down to the forest floor, finding wet leaves and fir needles, and no blackberry vines, because my dog and I had left the trail, she with her four good legs, and I with my one good one, walking and sliding where only the deer had passed before us. Or how 40 years ago, Bill and I walked every day to through the streets of Florence toward the attic we had rented in Bellascordo, carrying our dinner past Santa Maria del Carmine, where inside Massasio's man and woman fled paradise forever, trying to hide their terrible shame. We could go in any time we wanted and drop the lira into the slot, bringing light into the medieval darkness, and look upon their misery, their sorrow, as if they might instruct us on what or what not to do as we stumbled through the rest of our lives, where now I remember and return to them, because I do believe memory is a dwelling as singular as any place we've ever lived. Though in L.A., the tract where I grew up is a long-term parking lot for LAX, and the hill where my grandparents' house stood among the oil wells is a city park. Which is all to say that some of the places you live now may be erased or resurrected like that park, planted as it is with native plants, because, of course, it's still your choice. The way it was ours who failed at doing so much of what we said we'd do, failing you as history has failed all of us. But maybe you'll never find what you are looking for. Meaning you'll keep looking as I was the other night when I heard the cry of a female great horned owl and looked up as she hooted and flew from treetop to treetop at dusk, and then I did not think of you. I watched her fly. And finally, as for what is coming, there are always signs. Just think of the photo of my parents, divorced early in the Second World War, on the day they remarried, she with her wrist bandaged from working a punch press, he with his hands bandaged from shrapnel that lodged in his body for the rest of his life. In the photo, these two people who are still strangers to me look almost hopeful. But nothing good will come of it unless I count my own life. Born as I was some 10 years later of their second chance union, which took place as if upon an irradiated funeral pyre, the day after we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, about which they surely must have known. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.